Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, and we're on New Books in Eastern European Studies today and New Books Art and New Books History with our guest, Dr. Katarzyna Morawska-Muthasius. Welcome, Kasia, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Stephen.
So we're going to talk today about Kasia's new book. It's called Imaging and Mapping Eastern Europe, Sarmatia Europea to Post-Communist Bloc. This is published by Routledge in the series called Routledge Advances in Art and Visual Studies and published this year in 2021. So a little bit about our author. Dr. Katarzyna Morawska-Muthasius teaches art history at Birkbeck College, University of London. She was curator and deputy director of the National Museum in Warsaw, as well as guest professor at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Her publications include Borders in Art, Revisiting Kunstgeographie, published by the Polish Academy 2000, The National Museum in Warsaw Guide, Galleries and Study Collections, published by Muzeum Narodowe, National Museum, Warsaw 21, Kantor Was Here, Tadeusz Kantor in Great Britain, published by Black Dog in 2011 with Natalia Zajetska. From Museum Critique to the Critical Museum, Ashgate 2015 with Piotr Piotrowski, and the book today. So I want to start with a question for you, Kasia, as an art historian and as someone who's followed your work in the history of cartography and in the visual artifact. What was it that motivated you to write your book?
All right. So, yes, I have to start from saying that the book has been brewing for a very, very long time. And the decisive factor definitely was my move to Britain exactly at the time when Eastern Europe has emerged from behind the Berlin Wall and became a hot topic. It was difficult not to notice that it was ever present in the media, in TV documentary, but also increasingly in academe. It started to be widely researched. It was widely researched by historians, geographers, political scientists, but also by anthropologists, by sociologists, cultural historians, literature scholars. And there were three books which appeared at the time when I arrived in England, by Larry Wolf, Inventing Eastern Europe, Maria Todorova, Inventing the Balkans, and Vesna Goldsworthy, Inventing Ruritania. Maria Todorova was imagining the Balkans. So inventing was obviously the key term. And all those books focus on historiography, on travel diaries, studied literature. And for a person, who was by training an art historian, it was not difficult to notice that the topic of the visual production of Eastern Europe as an entity, by means of maps, there were many maps which would appear everywhere, in atlases, in newspapers, by means of cartoons. There were a number of cartoons of Eastern Europe as such, Eastern Europe as a region, magazine photographs, TV documentaries, et cetera. It was a virtually untrodden territory. So I felt invited very much to dive into it. Mm-hmm. And there is another factor, because not only that it was, decisive change with the visibility of Eastern Europe, but I also arrived in Britain at the time of profound changes in my discipline of art history, which forced me to reinvent myself completely. In Poland, I used to be curator of old masters' paintings, of Italian paintings, and in England, I had to, find a role in England, find a job also.
Yeah, of course.
So that was a long process, actually. But in order to do that, in order to become anybody in the field of art history, I had to learn new methods, adopt critical approach, learn about the post-colonial theory, be aware that now we are going to focus not on celebration the great masters, but looking for the traces of discrimination of the disempowered, of representing the other. Well, I'm kind of sound a bit cynical, but and it is easy to be cynical from the hindsight, but I took it very seriously at the time, as of course almost all of us. And that was also the time when the new discipline, in a way, within the remits of art history was being coined, visual culture, which differed from art history in that sense that instead of focusing just on old masters or just on those masterpieces, on mainstream art, it was open to all kinds of images. Popular culture, science, media, of course, on the gaze and visuality, social constructs, ways of seeing as the ways of knowing. And that was incredibly, that was very interesting for me. And I did an MA, although I already had a PhD from Poland, but I thought that I had to learn something completely new. And I was very happy, actually. I did an MA in Middlesex University in the topic of visual culture. And visual construction of Eastern Europe was my simply MA dissertation. It was an obvious topic for my new research. So that was, in a way, the beginning of the book. But I want to say something else, because there was one more stimulus. There was a comment made about my handwriting by my colleague, an art historian, a feminist, and who was very, author of very important publication and very well versed in the issues of art and exclusion. And she said that my handwriting is Eastern European.
So whatever that means.
My handwriting served as the marker of difference.
So interesting.
Yes, on the one hand, this confirmed the classification of Eastern Europe as an entity, so that was quite important for me already, as the unrecognized other at the time when it would be inappropriate to talk, for instance, about African handwriting as being recognizably different from British handwriting. So there is this kind of problematic issues which arise from that. But on the other hand, it provided me with this a very stimulating idea, how to assess, where is the difference? What is the Eastern European difference? Does my Polish handwriting stand for Eastern European handwriting as a whole? If so, what are its defining features? Can I apply visual analysis to find out, to assess, to somehow to grasp the Eastern Europeanness? And of course, this brought this question, eventually, is Eastern Europe an image? So this is how it all came about. And I started from looking at cartoons. Cartoons is my topic, in a way. It's my, we may say, I specialize in cartoons. But very soon, I move also onto maps. And I soon discovered the affinity between maps and cartoons, maps and caricature. And I wrote several articles, which now, of course, form the core of the book. But that was not the end. The book was brewing, as I said, for a terribly long time, because I started teaching art history at Birkbeck. So I had to, again, reinvent myself, kind of going back to the older, to the new art history and teaching, of course, the new methods of art history, teaching various topics. That took my mind away from the book. Of course, I didn't have time for that, simply. Mm-hmm. Then came the period when I was deputy director in the National Museum in Warsaw, which also took my time definitely away from the book.
Kasia, I think you've been everywhere. And I want to, you know, give our readers an impression of your versatility. I wonder if we could do this by talking a little bit about the chapters that you have and the content of the book. So, you know, one thing that really struck me, it really strikes me is the image that you have for your cover. And I hope, you know, our listeners will take a very close look and inspection at the work by the artist Katarzyna Perlak. Mm-hmm. How was it that you decided to choose cartoons, maps, some photographs? You know, what was it that led you to kind of curate the content of your book into the five chapters, including the, you know, sort of fantasy countries like Slaka out of Malcolm Bradbury? How did you go about choosing those sources?
Yes, no, it's a very good question. It was a very long process. You know, I had to select certain groups, certain types of representation or visual representation, which would feature in my book. At the beginning, I was simply trying to find as much as I could. And perhaps I should say, because you mentioned Slaka, so I was also inspired by Malcolm Bradbury and his novels, Rates of Exchange and Why Come to Slaka, which I talk about them in the introduction. And then, I cannot say that they have nothing to do with images, because both of those books had very interesting covers. Right. So that was my beginning of my interest in book covers. But you asked me about my chapter. So I devote my interest to, first of all, to, I started from cartoons, but this is the chapter kind of three, or it's chapter four, I think. Cartoons was, studying cartoons in Punch, was the beginning. I spent a long time first looking at those bound volumes of Punch in various libraries, going through them and photocopying images of cartoons of Eastern Europe. And it was a fascinating, and it was a happy time of my life doing this research. But how did I come to maps? Now, I must say, I can't remember the exact moment, but I think, there are quite a lot of maps in cartoons already.
That's a great point. Yeah.
I studied, my interest in cartography and the image of Eastern Europe began from looking at those political diagrams, those geopolitical diagrams produced by Hafod Mackinder, or those kind of sympathetic diagrams produced by Robert Seton Watson, I always looked for images, for maps of the whole region. I would not add up maps of Poland or Bohemia, Hungary or the Balkans. I was interested in the representation of the region, how this image of Eastern Europe, of this Eastern Europeanness, came about. So initially, I wanted to focus just on the 20th century and on England, starting from Punch and from those geopolitical diagrams. But I could not stop there. I could not possibly begin the book from making their diagrams without contextualizing them. This is my training in iconology in Poland. You know, when I was a curator of old masters, I learned art history in Poland. I was a student of Professor Jan Białostocki, who promoted iconology as a method. So you cannot just leave an image alone. You know, you always have to trace the iconographical code to which that image belongs. So this is how I began going into other maps, which preceded Mackinder and Seton Watson's diagrams. I also was fascinated by the map on the cover of, which was chosen by Larry Wolf for the cover of his book Inventing Eastern Europe. This is a very interesting map. It's not a typical map because it presents the itinerary of Szabdotrosz, the astronomer, who began his travel from Tours in France and finished in Tobolsk in Siberia. But there is also there are also cartographic bodies. It is not just the itinerary as such, but this itinerary was juxtaposed to a personification of France, personification of Holy Roman Empire, and both of them, of those ladies, were obviously noble persons in magnificent clothes and headgears and sitting on the throne and beautifully lit. And they were juxtaposed to two personification of Poland, because the astronomer had to cross Poland going to Russia, and Russia. And in spite of the fact that Russia was also an empire at that time already, and Poland was still a kingdom, those personification were incredibly humble. You know, they were folk, they were peasants, they were warriors, but a kind of low type of warriors. Mm-hmm. So this cover was, I mean, cover of Larry Wolf's book, but of course I have to find out about Szabdotrosz and his travel diary. And this brought me onto travel images.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions for you about that.
So eventually my book contains of, in a way, four major chapters, one about maps, one about travel images, one about cartoons, and the final one on book covers.
Yeah, I want to come back to the last chapter because I was so fascinated by the Battle of the Dust Jackets, as you call it. You're actually doing something that, you know, that very few people do, historicizing and contextualizing the choice of art or the choice of photographs on some of the canonical works in the field of Russian, East European, Eurasian studies. I want to come back to that because, you know, you have, I think, a really interesting take on exhibition catalogs and art publications as well as photography. But I did want to ask you if you could talk a little bit about travel writing and the traveler's gaze. I know you mentioned Larry Wolfe and Todorova and Goldsworthy, and probably Mary Louise Pratt belongs in this category as well. I mean, the work of Wendy Bracewell and Alex Drace Francis and others. So how do you put a postcolonial critique or a postcolonial approach into your understanding of the visual as well as the textual in the travel writing on Eastern Europe?
Okay, that was quite a dense question. The travel images, are already the other. This is one question. This is one issue that images are very rarely studied in travel genre studies. So this is one other. I looked at those travel books and I started looking at books which were published in the 17th century. I didn't find any other travel books with images which I could take into account. I lost my plot actually.
I'm interested in the travel gaze and how you incorporate post-colonial criticism. You mentioned new art history, but I suspect that you had a pretty deep encounter with post-colonial theory and the visual turn. So how do you then begin to explore that in your analysis in the book?
Well, yes. There is this, you've already mentioned Mary Louise Pratt and the contrast between the traveler and the travelee. So the travelee is the other. And in a way obviously you can apply post-colonial theory to study the way in which the travelee is being described. But you can also use the post-colonial theory to study the way in which the travelee is being visualized, is being represented. So I think this is a kind of pretty straightforward application of post-colonial tenets, the concept of the epistemological violence, the way in which you represent the travelee and misrepresented. I struggle with the answer here. And perhaps the reason is that because I've been writing about that for such a long time, and when I started writing about the representation of Eastern Europe as the other, I was very much into post-colonial theory, and I would constantly talk about the other misrepresentation, the epistemic violence, the disempowerment, etc., etc. And I'm not saying that I want to abandon such an approach, but for me, there are things that have already been said. So post-colonial sensitivities accompany my thinking and writing about the representation of Eastern Europe, but this is not the it's not the topic in itself. It's not the end. It's not the end of my research. But obviously, it was difficult not to find out that Eastern Europe, that the signifier of Eastern Europe since the 17th century, since the earliest travel books which account travels to those territories, including Edward Brown's brief account of his travels to this remote parts of Europe, that they include invariably image of the ethnic body of the peasant woman in her ethnic dress. This is really, when I have realized that only after going through several books, it reappeared. It appeared in Edward Brown. The same image appeared as the first image in Alberto Forti's Viaggio in Dalmazia. And in 19th century travel books, and then in National Geographic. I use National Geographic quite a lot.
You do have a lot of photos from Nat Geo. I wanted to ask you about some of those. Can you give some examples of how you see the ethnic body portrayed? Are there stages? Is it evolving over time? Is it gendered in a particular way? I mean, I do think Edward Brown is a really important, you know, sort of 17th century scientist and travel writer. But I guess I'm wondering if in the sort of Western traveler's gaze from National Geographic, you see some key changes, whether, you know, in photography or drawing.
There are many changes, but at the same time, there is still the same body. It could be a peasant, but later on it is not necessarily a peasant woman. It could be a kind of middle class woman. It could be an artist who could put on an ethnic dress. She's performing in a way Eastern Europeanness, or Polishness, or Slovakness,
Bulgarianness,
etc. So. But it is still this timeless. This is the most stable signifier of Eastern Europe. This the most recognizable image. This is what I have arrived at. This that was my conclusion going through travel books, but also cartoons. That the image of the ethnic body, it is most often than not, it's a woman, but not necessarily in cartoons. In travel images, it is mostly a woman, and she's obviously gendered. She must be beautiful. There are very few images of women who are old, but of course she changes. So she's both timeless. She is Eastern Europe as such. You know, when we see a woman in ethnic dress, which includes those typical features of Eastern Europeanness, such as linen shirt, embroidered linen shirt, and sumptuous skirt. She must be Eastern European. She's an unmistakably she's a signifier of Eastern Europe, but yes, at the beginning she's as I have written in my book, she's an enigma for Edward Brown. He cannot really make her out. He drew her because he was a draftsman at the same time, and so he drew her in a very interesting way, when he was describing a Hungarian nobleman, he described it with such an ease. Everything was easy, you know. He was able to name all the parts of the dress, and it was a kind of discourse, already an established discourse. He knew how to describe him, but he didn't really know how to describe the Bulgarian woman. There was a problem with her headgear, because he knew that it is of Turkish or Greek origin, actually. But so that was already somehow, it didn't fit. So this her ethnicity was already complex. But the major thing is that he decided to include the image of the Bulgarian woman, who is represented in a sympathetic way. I cannot see any attempt on his part to, in a way, misrepresent her. He actually presents her as a very skillful person. She is she's very neatly dressed, and she holds a big fruit, probably a pumpkin or a melon. She has got keys hanging from her belt, so she's obviously a person with some authority. She's a peasant woman who is it's obviously what I have noticed with Edward Brown, who was a scientist, that he often represented, he often drew things which have not been drawn before him. You know, he didn't have a model.
Right. Which, right.
There was not a visual code that he could answer. Or maybe I'm not totally right, because there are, of course, costume books. Costume books, I did actually study the books which were produced at the time and which might have been available to Edward Brown, and none of them would include a woman like that. You know, mostly represented nobility, and there was no Bulgarian nobility at the time.
I think of all the sort of writing on Transylvania as well in this context, and you know, you mentioned the veil. The Shalvari is such an interesting, you know, sort of representation of Bulgarianness versus Ottoman Europe. I mean, if you have the veil sort of around your neck, you look more like a Bulgarian peasant woman. But if you have it around your head or maybe around your face, obviously this is coding it in a very different way. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, I'm wondering how that changes over time, both as a sort of signifier of the hegemonic and the counter hegemonic, for lack of a better word, because this is also a big theme in your book, when the signifier is resistance.
Yes, I mentioned this veil only in the context of 20th century photography. So the Bulgarian woman at Brown's drawing, she doesn't have a veil. She doesn't have a headkerchief, which would evolve later on into another signifier of an Eastern European woman. But you are talking about signs of resistance. So, well, we can...
Let's talk about that in the context of your cartoons as well.
Yes, because they're, immediately right. From a Bulgarian woman represented by Brown to those two women from Katarzyna Perlak's film. This is... They, in a way... they belong to the same iconographic code. This would be now called folk culture, you know. They look like a standard image, which could be used by tourism industry or even politicians who wanted to gain support from the various large audiences, largest audiences as possible. However, they differ from this. This kind of serene, unproblematic image by the fact that, and it is instantly recognizable.
Balaclavas.
Exactly. But they have those balaclava masks. So something is wrong here. Obviously, they hide something, or the image points to something hidden, which is not visible. So those masks on the girls' faces, they destabilize the image, they explode the notion of folk as the guardian of public decency, as the guardian of traditional values, and remap, as it were.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's exactly right. Go ahead. Sorry, I got enthusiastic about this.
Folk culture as the potential and, in fact, the real medium of dissent. And this is absolutely fantastic, and therefore I put this image on the cover, because it both stands for Eastern Europe, and at the same time it queers it. It queers it in a literal sense of the way, sense of the term, because those girls actually they sing a song which sounds the same like the traditional Polish songs about two lovers, but the change in the ending, you know, those gender ending, makes it absolutely clear that those two lovers are women. That this is a this is a lesbian song. So, obviously you cannot hear it in the image, but you can see the subversion, you can see this resistance, the folk as the medium, as the site of resistance through balaclava masks. I mean, you can guess that there is something.
My first thought, Kasia, when I saw the image, and I saw it actually before your book by Perelak, was to think of Pussy Riot and, you know, a sort of non-space that's actually a space that's a sort of queertopia. And I think that that's really, I mean, how you trace this backwards through, you know, both photography and visual artifacts like cartoons is really interesting. I mean, people have to read your chapters on on Mr. Punch and on other sort of satirical representations to tease out the counter-hegemonic element of this as a form of resistance. I wonder if you could say a word about these satirical magazines that existed during the communist period and that also, you know, sort of went out of business. Crocodile is probably the most famous example of this in 2008 or so, but there were, you know, satirical cartoons and examples out of the Eastern Bloc, or at least out of Warsaw Pact countries. So how do you conceptualize that visual archive into the iconosphere?
Well, this is a fascinating topic. And in fact, I told you that I started from cartoons, and I actually, in order to make it short, I said that I started from studying cartoons in Punch. But this is not. The truth is that my research on cartoons began from looking at Eastern European, but mostly Polish cartoons.
Mleczko or somebody else?
Mleczko came slightly later, and that was, of course, Mleczko was very important, Andrzej Mleczko's cartoons, and Andrzej Krause, who is actually living in London. I was absolutely fascinated by the 1950s. Late 1940s and the early 1950s, you know, the heat of the Cold War, and cartoons had nothing to do with socialist realism. Cartoons were incredibly, you know, experimental, innovative, very strong, very individual. You know, you can recognize the cartoonist style, hand. This is how my fascination with cartoons began. And I discovered that you can learn quite a lot about history, about what was happening there. Obviously, this is a very, you know, opinionated version of history. Nonetheless, both going through those Polish satirical journals, and I did a huge study then. I went through, or perhaps not all of them, but many journals I looked at, those both everyday newspapers and journals such as Szpilki. I also Szpilki, that is pins. I spent quite a long time, even in the archives. That's a very nice place actually to learn about Szpilki. I mean, it still exists, and it's very well. As far as cartoons are concerned, one of my research topic was the representation of the West. And I wrote some time ago an article, which then I published in various languages, the imperialist warmonger. So this is how I included parts of this text in this book. So I wanted to juxtapose the image of Eastern Europe as produced by Punch, the Eastern European group person formula, which was invented by Punch, and which consisted of, you know, of a group of children in folk costumes running around either quarreling amongst themselves, sometimes beating, sometimes, but or also bullied by Dame Europa or dictators. So, and image of the Eastern European and this image of the Eastern European group person as a, you know, as a this as a bunch. As a bunch of people who are difficult to manage, you cannot really trust them. You can bully them. Who are prone to be subjugated. This was in a way. This lasted for a very long time until the end of the Cold War. I have found many cartoons, not only in British newspapers, but even in German newspapers, such as FAZ, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which included the same formula, which must have been borrowed from Punch. So this formula, it was in a way, I mean, the answer from the East, in this case, I'm talking about the Polish cartoons, but not only the Polish cartoons used the same thing, was to represent the West as the other. However, the West, it would never include the people.
Abstracted.
Who are, yes, abstracted, running around and so on, it would be always associated, would be always embodied by the politicians, by the people in the government who will be accused for of warmongering, such as Winston Churchill, of course, who was not actually accused firstly by Eastern European, I mean, made into warmonger by Eastern Europeans, but still, this cartoon by Boris Yefimov, which I'm including in my book, that was one of the most one of the strongest representation of Churchill as a warmonger. Represented as a kind of bear in the circus, as obese, as branding those hand grenades and establishing Iron Curtain over Europe, right. Because it was right. In the context of the Iron Curtain speech.
I mean, you have so many interesting images. I mean, the one of the Truman line was also very striking to me, because obviously there's a Cold War context, as you know, Larry Wolf and others have argued, back not just to the 1940s, but to the 18th century, where you have this trope of domination and power. I mean, I think of the Sakura Mazok part of his book, and, you know, I mean, these group identities that are established, but often of fictitious people, like Morlocks, for instance. You know, that was really an inspiration for me in getting started dealing with maps and the so-called tipi and vidi, like what Rogers Brubaker has argued on how to establish groupism and group belonging, and then, of course, how to sort of signify resistance to it. I wanted to ask you, Kasia, because I'm fascinated by the last chapter, 5, after you talk about Punch magazine and mapping and so on. What brought you to write about dust jackets? This is just an absolutely wonderful chapter, because you've got, you know, like the iconic photo of Michnik and Havel and Curran. You have you know, how Paul Magocci's historical atlas changed from Eastern Europe to East Central Europe to Central Europe. You have, you know, even like books up to the present, John Connolly, or sort of Liberation Brigade books, Kristen Godsey's book. What brought you to sort of, you know, use all of your talents as a historian of the visual turn in art history to sort of contextualize this? How do you do that? What are you saying?
Well, it was actually a very fascinating adventure for me. Well, I have to say, if I have time, I have to start from the very beginning when I started my research on Eastern Europe, and I remember my wandering in library among the, you know, dusted shelves and trying to find and finding those books, those shelves which were devoted to Eastern Europe, and all those books were incredibly uninteresting in visual terms. They didn't have dust jackets because they might have been produced with dust jackets, but you know, dust jackets were seen as something inappropriate, so they had been torn away and probably thrown away. So it was completely. It forced me to read always the table of contents whenever I wanted to assess what the book is about, and it forced me to read the book. I didn't have this kind of visual signifier which started appearing. There were some books which were published in the 1990s already with an image on the cover, and they were my saviors, as it were. You know, that was easier for me. Perhaps erroneously, to think that I know what the book is going to be about, judging the book from its cover. That's another topic, of course, that you cannot really do it, but I claim in my book that you can do it, because the cover is this space where the idea of the author, the ideas of the publisher, and ideas of the designer collide. Yeah.
Packaging, right? The package, I guess, or the brand with the signature of the author. Would you say that?
It is. It might be, but not necessarily so. I suppose, for instance, your books, they always have very interesting cover, and I'm pretty sure that you are involved in actually thinking about it. But many books have cover designed by designers. And as it happens, sometimes those cover have nothing to do with the real contents of the book. This is a kind of general statement about the features of Eastern Europe. Of Eastern Europeanness. Nonetheless, I consider them very important, even if I consider the choice of image as the kind of the act of first reading of the book, of this collision between the text and the ideas of what is Eastern Europe, which have formed or are being formed in the mind of the designer. So the period when in the new millennium, when there were this almost overproduction of books on Eastern Europe, and they many of them coming with fascinating covers, was a godsend for me. A godsend in that sense that cartoonists and cartographers have somehow abandoned the topic of Eastern Europe. Not completely, but there aren't that many maps of Eastern Europe which are being produced today. And there are very few cartoons of Eastern Europe as an entity which is produced today. But this is, completely reversed this process of the vanishing of the image of Eastern Europe is reversed on book covers, which compensate this disappearance by and producing using the old imagery, but also producing new ones. Hence the battle of the dust jackets. This is, of course, I referred to Swift and the Battle of the Books.
I refer to Swift too. I really wonder why this is the case. It is a vanishing. I mean, I think about, obviously, you know, lines or annexations or incorporations, and here Crimea or North Macedonia or something like that, right? But I think you're right. I mean, there has been, at least maybe since 2014, much less of a production of visual knowledge with actual maps. And I wonder why that is. I mean, in your book, you have so many interesting abstract designs, and I would say, I would call them counter-hegemonic maps. But I really, until I had read your book, I hadn't thought of it that way. I was still thinking, you know, in the Wolf Todorova Goldsworthy 1990s tradition. So I wanted, since we're kind of running out of time, if I could ask you about some books that you might recommend to our audience here at New Books Network, and it could be in art history or anything else that you're interested in.
Well, I was thinking about books which are related actually to my topic. So I would definitely, as far as maps are concerned, I have two candidates. One is Katarina Piechocki. Her book, Cartographic Humanism, The Making of Early Modern Europe, published by Chicago in 2019, a beautifully written book, a kind of reflection, but very deep reflection on the relationship between map and literature and culture, which was inspirational for me. Then, of course, this is, and I actually have to say, your book, Mapmen, as far as the later periods are concerned, was also a very important reading, and increasingly so, I must say. I would prefer more images, though, Stephen.
Me too. It makes it so expensive. I'm constantly putting up that fight. You know how it is, because it makes the book so expensive, right?
Yes, I also had to spend loads of money on my images, and I had to resign from some because they were simply too expensive, and they would not come out very nice anyway. So now you've already mentioned Wendy Braswell and Alex Drace Francis, Under Eastern Eyes, and other books that they have produced together on East European travel writing. It is actually, they did not write about travels to Eastern Europe, but there are some chapters in the books they produced which includes traveling to Eastern Europe. And it is Eva Manikowska, a book which I have discovered quite recently, and I'm very angry that I had not known about it when I was writing the book. Eva Manikowska, my former colleague from the National Museum in Warsaw, who doesn't work in the museum anymore, and she published a book on photography and cultural heritage in the age of nationalisms, Eastern Europe, Europe's Eastern Borderlands, published first by Bloomsbury and then republished or reissued by Routledge. It is full of very interesting images of also of ethnic bodies. So, but I think this is the text-wise, the books is also in very interesting and worth reading. As far as cartoons are concerned, this is the most difficult topic. I haven't got such a book that I would like to recommend. Of course, there are many books that I have read, but Martha Banta, Barbaric Intercourse, Caricature and the Culture of Conduct, published a long time ago in 2003, would be still perhaps the number one, apart from those classical authors on caricature such as Gombrich. And the book, which I as far as dust jackets are concerned, I would definitely recommend the collection of texts edited by Dennis Duncan and Adam Smith.
Oh, I don't know that.
Yes, it was published by Oxford University Press. It is called Book Parts. And it is a wonderful collection of very short texts, which include dust jacket, but book covers and title pages and table of contents, footnotes. And there are many, many chapters in this book, short with very good literature. It's a fantastic reading. So this is my selection.
Fabulous. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think of all the books about China and Russia and the Soviet Union that have red book covers, someone has to write about that someday.
Yes. Oh, definitely.
Right. And so, Kasia, what are you working on now? This is the last kind of 2-minute question. What are your projects and research interests?
Yes. Now, obviously, there will be some, I will have to do some more things on imaging Eastern Europe. But a research project that I look forward to after that, I'm returning to caricature, and I'm preparing, I will be preparing a book under the title that I have now established, but of course that will change, Insult and Inquiry, Cultures of Caricature. And I want to write about caricature as a critical art form, and include a lot of Eastern Europe, but also will be also traditional caricature. You remember, I was in Italian painting specially, so I also know about Italian caricature in early modern period. But I also want to look at cultures of caricature in non-Western countries, and I think about India and Argentina. And the final, and this is related to that, I want to do it, and rather in collaboration with other authors, the caricature reader. I think this is something that is really missing.
Would that be Routledge or something like that? Or...
I'm not sure yet. Because this is really, I have not, this is
great idea.
I just started thinking about it, but it's definitely must be included and starting from early modern writers.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea. I mean, Duke University Press has those sort of country reader series, but I would love to see something like that for visual studies. Fabulous. Look, I wanted to say thank you to Katarzyna Morawska-Muthesius for joining us here on the podcast here at New Books Network. We have been talking with her about her new book, which is published by Routledge in 2021 and the Routledge Advances in Art and Visual Studies series. The book is called Imaging and Mapping Eastern Europe, Sarmatia Europea to Post-Communist Bloc. Congratulations to you. Gratulacje, Kasia. Thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast today.
Thank you so much.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here on New Books Eastern European Studies and the New Books Network. Until next time.